A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He wants us to map out the spectrum of ideas for fixing or replacing capitalism. We've told before about whether capitalism has reached some kind of crisis point, whether the term late-stage capitalism actually means anything, and he's pointing to the rental crisis in Israel as an example of what happens when shelter becomes a pure commodity. He mentioned Sir Ronald Cohen and the impact investing crowd, the let's tinker with it school, versus people who say the whole thing is rotten and needs replacing. The question is, if we lined up every proposal from mildest tweak to full revolution, what does that gradient actually look like?
This is one of those questions where the framing itself does a lot of work. Because once you start plotting things on a spectrum, you immediately see that the categories people use in everyday argument, capitalist, socialist, reformist, they collapse into each other at the edges. Someone's radical reform is someone else's tepid centrism.
The political equivalent of arguing about whether a hot dog is a sandwich.
And the answer is yes, but that's not helpful. So let's actually build this spectrum. I think the most useful way to organize it is by what each proposal wants to change. The rules of the game, the players, the scorekeeping, or the game itself.
That's a good frame. Start me at the mild end. What's the smallest possible thing someone could propose and still claim they're fixing capitalism's defects?
I'd put better disclosure at the shallow end of the pool. The idea that if companies just reported more information, carbon emissions, pay ratios, supply chain labor conditions, markets would self-correct because consumers and investors would make better choices. The EU's Corporate Sustainability Reporting Directive is basically this. It says capitalism works fine, the information pipes are just clogged.
The capitalism has a transparency problem, not a greed problem, school.
And the critique writes itself. Chevron publishes gorgeous sustainability reports. They've got photos of smiling people and bar charts that go the right direction. Hasn't exactly stopped them from being Chevron.
Covering the covers.
Step one rung up from that is ESG integration, environmental, social, governance factors baked into investment decisions. This is where Ronald Cohen lives. His argument, which he laid out in that book, Impact, is that we need to add a third dimension to how we measure value, risk, return, and impact. The idea is that if impact becomes a priced variable, if a company's social and environmental effects show up on the balance sheet, then capital will flow toward the good actors naturally. You don't need to ban anything or nationalize anything.
The invisible hand just gets a second thumb.
That's actually a perfect way to put it. Cohen's whole pitch is that this isn't anti-capitalist at all. It's completing capitalism. He argues that the current system is actually incomplete because it externalizes costs. Impact accounting brings those externalities inside the tent. He helped create the UK's big society capital and various social impact bonds. There's real infrastructure behind this now. How do you quantify impact in a way that's comparable across a tech company and a mining company? You end up with rating agencies, MSCI, Sustainalytics, assigning scores that are basically black boxes. Second, there's evidence that ESG ratings correlate more with how much money a company spends on disclosure than with actual outcomes. And third, the more fundamental critique, if a business model is extractive by design, assigning it an impact score doesn't change the extraction, it just makes everyone feel better about it.
Like putting a Fitbit on a chain smoker.
That's the critique, yeah. But Cohen would say you're missing the point. Once impact is priced, the extractive model becomes more expensive than the regenerative one and capital shifts. The mechanism is supposed to work over time.
ESG is the fix the dashboard approach. What's next?
This is the idea that corporations should serve not just shareholders, but all stakeholders. Employees, communities, suppliers, the environment. The Business Roundtable made headlines in 2019 when they dropped the old shareholder primacy statement and endorsed stakeholder capitalism. Klaus Schwab at the World Economic Forum has been pushing this for decades.
This is where people's eyes start glazing over because it sounds like a corporate retreat slogan.
But it's actually a meaningful shift in governance philosophy. Under pure shareholder primacy, the Milton Friedman doctrine, a CEO's only job is to maximize returns to shareholders within the bounds of law. Everything else is mission creep. Stakeholder capitalism says no, your fiduciary duty extends to workers and communities too. In practice, this shows up as things like employee representation on boards, which Germany has had since the 1970s through co-determination laws. Workers at large German companies elect up to half the supervisory board.
It's not just vibes. There are actually legal structures.
And the B Corp movement is another example. Companies that legally commit to stakeholder governance in their charter. Danone did this in France, though they walked it back a few years later under shareholder pressure, which kind of illustrates the problem. If stakeholder governance is voluntary and shareholders can revolt, is it actually a structural change or just a marketing decision?
That's the thing with a lot of these middle spectrum ideas. They word beautifully until someone's quarterly bonus is at stake.
That's exactly the pivot point to the next band. Once you accept that voluntary measures keep hitting the same wall, you start looking at mandatory reforms. This is where we get into things like wealth taxes, universal basic income, stronger antitrust enforcement, public options for essential services.
We've moved from let's ask nicely to let's change the rules.
And this is where the spectrum gets interesting because you start seeing crossovers between people who identify as capitalists and people who don't. Elizabeth Warren's account system for big tech, forcing platforms to separate their marketplace from their own products, that's a regulatory fix within a capitalist framework. But it's also the kind of structural intervention that socialists have advocated for decades. The label starts mattering less than the mechanism.
Let's talk about UBI for a second, because that's one of those ideas that's somehow both radical and deeply pragmatic depending on who's pitching it.
Universal basic income is fascinating precisely because it sits at a hinge point on the spectrum. On one hand, Milton Friedman proposed a version of it, the negative income tax, as a way to streamline welfare without disrupting market incentives. On the other hand, post-capitalist thinkers see UBI as a bridge out of wage labor entirely. The same policy, completely different theories of change behind it.
It's either the ultimate capitalist safety net, or the first step toward a world where nobody has to work. Depends on the brochure.
And that ambiguity is why it's gained traction across ideological lines. Andrew Yang ran on it in 2020 from a pretty pro-market position. His argument was about automation displacing workers and needing to keep the consumer economy functioning. Meanwhile, people like the Belgian philosopher Philippe Van Parijs have been arguing for UBI since the 80s as a matter of justice, the idea that everyone deserves a share of the social inheritance.
What about the experiments? I remember Finland did one.
Finland ran a 2-year trial ending in 2018. 2,000 unemployed people got about 560 euros a month, no strings attached. The big finding was that they weren't more likely to find work than the control group. But they were significantly happier, less stressed, and reported better health. Stockton, California did a smaller trial with positive results. Kenya's been running a 12-year study across hundreds of villages. The evidence base is building.
UBI still operates within a market economy. Everyone still buys things. Prices still exist. Capital still accumulates.
Which is why it sits in the reform band, not the replacement band. Now let's move further along. The next major category is what I'd call predistribution, changing who owns the productive assets in the first place, rather than just redistributing income after the fact.
This is where we get into actual structural changes to who holds capital.
Employee stock ownership plans, ESOPs, are the entry-level version. In the US, there are about 6,000 ESOP companies covering roughly 14 million workers. Public supermarkets, for instance, is entirely employee-owned. These are still capitalist firms competing in markets, but the ownership structure is fundamentally different. The workers capture the upside.
The evidence on how these perform.
ESO companies tend to have lower turnover, higher productivity, and they're more resilient during downturns because they don't do mass layoffs the way publicly traded firms do when they need to hit quarterly numbers. But they're still a minority share of the economy. Scaling them requires serious policy changes, tax incentives, lending structures, education for business owners looking to exit.
ESOPs are like capitalism, but the workers get to be the capitalists. What's the next step beyond that?
Full worker ownership and democratic governance. This isn't just owning shares. It's one worker, one vote on major decisions. The Mondragon Corporation in Spain's Basque Country is the flagship example. Founded in 1956, it's now a federation of about 95 cooperatives employing over 80,000 people. They make everything from industrial machinery to bicycles. During the 2008 financial crisis, when Spain's unemployment hit 26%, Mondragon's worker owners voted to reduce pay rather than lay people off.
That's a real stress test. Most corporations during a crisis, the first thing they do is jettison payroll.
And Mondragon survived. But it's worth noting they're not immune to market pressures. They've had to close some units, they compete globally, they have their own internal tensions. The point isn't that cooperatives are a utopia. The point is, they demonstrate a different governance model can function at scale within a market system.
This still feels like it's within capitalism, though. They're still competing, still pricing goods, still accumulating capital. They've just changed who's in the boardroom.
That's the question that divides the spectrum. For some people on the left, co-ops are the horizon, market socialism, where markets exist, but capital is broadly held and democratically governed. For others, co-ops are a stepping stone to something further. Because even in a fully co-op economy, you still have market competition, which means you still have winners and losers, and over time, successful co-ops can accumulate power just like corporations do.
The logic of competition doesn't care about your governance model.
Which brings us to the next band, degrowth and steady-state economics. This is where the critique stops being about who owns what and starts being about the growth imperative itself.
Now we're in the deep end.
The core argument from degrowth thinkers, people like Jason Hickel, Giorgos Kallas, Kate Raworth, is that endless GDP growth on a finite planet is a suicide pact. You cannot have 3% compound growth forever when the material throughput required hits planetary boundaries. So the solution isn't to make growth greener or more inclusive. It's to abandon growth as the organizing principle of the economy entirely.
This is where the late-stage capitalism language actually lives. The idea that the system's internal logic, grow or die, has become incompatible with human flourishing.
And it's worth noting that the term late capitalism itself has a specific intellectual history. It didn't start on Twitter. The Belgian Marxist economist Ernest Mandel used it in the 1970s to describe a particular phase of capitalism characterized by multinational corporations, globalized production, and the expansion of capital into every sphere of life. It wasn't originally a prediction of imminent collapse. It was a description of a mature phase.
The internet turned it into a punchline, but it had a real meaning.
Frederick Jameson picked it up in the 80s and 90s as a cultural analysis, like capitalism, as the cultural logic of postmodernism, where everything becomes commodified, including art, identity, and relationships. That's actually closer to how people use it now in casual speech. The feeling that there's nothing left that hasn't been turned into a product.
Including, in our previous conversations, shelter. When housing stops being homes and becomes an asset class, that's the Jameson vibe.
So degrowth takes that diagnosis and prescribes a deliberate, planned reduction in energy and material throughput, coupled with a reorganization of society around well-being rather than GDP. Kate Raworth's donut economics is the most accessible version. The idea that the economy should operate within a safe and just space, between a social foundation where everyone's needs are met and an ecological ceiling we can't exceed.
Amsterdam adopted the donut model, didn't they?
They did in 2020. Amsterdam became the first city to formally adopt donut economics as a policy framework, using it to guide their post-pandemic recovery strategy. The city's circular economy plan, housing policy, and food strategy all reference the donut. It's a real-world test case.
Degrowth has a marketing problem. It sounds like austerity with a smile.
It absolutely does. And critics on the left and right both make that point. The right says it's poverty politics dressed up as virtue. Parts of the left say it's a distraction from the real issue, which is power and ownership. That the problem isn't growth per se, it's who controls the growth and who gets the proceeds. The degrowth response is that you can't redistribute your way out of ecological collapse. Even if you perfectly equalize everything, if the total pie keeps growing, you still hit the wall.
Degrowth says the pie itself needs to shrink, and we need to learn to live with a smaller pie. That's a tough sell politically.
It's an almost impossible sell in the current political landscape, which is why some thinkers in this space have shifted to talking about post-growth or beyond growth rather than degrowth. The idea is to stop optimizing for growth, not necessarily to shrink. Let the economy find its level based on well-being indicators rather than GDP.
Which feels like a semantic dodge, but I understand the political instinct.
Now, if degrowth is the radical ecological critique, the next step further out is what gets called fully automated luxury communism, a term that started as a joke and then people took seriously.
As all good political movements do.
The idea, associated with thinkers like Aaron Bastani, is that technological automation should be harnessed not to displace workers into precarity, but to liberate everyone from necessary labor entirely. Fully automated production, universal basic services, not just income, but housing, healthcare, transport, education, all provided as public goods, and the freedom to pursue whatever you want because the robots are doing the boring stuff.
It's Star Trek economics. Replicators, no money, everyone just does what they're passionate about.
That's literally the reference. Bastani's book is called Fully Automated Luxury Communism, and the subtitle is A Manifesto. The argument is that the technology to provide abundance already exists or is close, renewable energy getting cheaper, AI and robotics advancing, but the capitalist framework constrains it to profit-seeking applications rather than human need. We could have solved scarcity by now. We chose not to.
The critique being, presumably, that someone has to build and maintain the robots, and that political economy doesn't evaporate just because the technology exists.
Who controls the automation infrastructure? Who decides what gets produced? The fully automated luxury communism vision tends to be light on governance details. It's more of a horizon than a blueprint, but it's influential because it reframes automation as an opportunity rather than a threat.
What's the far edge of the spectrum?
The far edge is anarcho-syndicalism and communalism, the abolition of both the state and the market as organizing principles. This is where we get into Murray Bookchin's social ecology, the idea of libertarian municipalism, where communities govern themselves through direct democracy and the economy is organized through confederated cooperatives. No bosses, no mayors, no stock exchanges.
Rojava comes up in these conversations.
Yes, the autonomous administration in northeastern Syria has been trying to implement Bookchin's ideas since around 2012, under extremely difficult conditions. They've set up communal councils, women's cooperatives, and an economic model based on shared ownership. It's a real experiment, but it's also happening in a war zone with an embargo, so it's hard to draw clean conclusions.
Then beyond even that, you get into the territory of fully automated space communism or whatever. But at that point, we're writing science fiction.
Which is not nothing, by the way. A lot of these ideas incubate in fiction before they become political programs. Ursula Le Guin's The Dispossessed is basically a novel-length thought experiment about an anarchist society. Kim Stanley Robinson's Mars trilogy works through the practical challenges of building a post-capitalist economy from scratch. Fiction lets you stress-test ideas without breaking actual people.
Let's pull back and look at this spectrum we've built. From mild to wild, roughly better disclosure, ESG and impact investing, stakeholder capitalism, mandatory regulation, NUBI, employee ownership and ESOPs, worker cooperatives and market socialism, degrowth and steady state economics, fully automated luxury communism, and then anarcho-syndicalism. Does that feel right?
I think it's a reasonable map, but I want to complicate it in one way. A lot of these ideas aren't actually on a single left-right axis. Some of them cut across in weird ways. Universal basic income, as we noted, has support from libertarians who want to dismantle the welfare state and from socialists who want to dismantle wage labor. Employee ownership has support from conservative Catholics who believe in the dignity of work and from Marxists who believe in seizing the means of production.
The political equivalent of a roundabout where everyone's coming from different directions and briefly sharing the same road.
And that's actually a useful corrective to the way these debates usually play out online, where everyone's sorted into neat teams. The real intellectual landscape is messier. Sir Ronald Cohen and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez probably agree on some things about corporate governance. They'd never admit it, but the Venn diagram overlaps.
What's the common thread then? If there is one, what unifies all of these from ESG to anarcho-syndicalism?
I think it's a shared recognition that the current arrangement has a legitimacy problem. Whether you think the fix is a tax incentive or a revolution depends on how deep you think the legitimacy problem goes. But the starting diagnosis, that something is broken in the relationship between economic activity and human well-being, that's the common ground.
It's not just a fringe position anymore. The fact that the Business Roundtable felt compelled to issue a statement redefining the purpose of a corporation, that's an establishment signal that the old consensus is crumbling.
When the CEO of BlackRock is writing annual letters about stakeholder capitalism, you know the conversation has moved. Larry Fink's 2022 letter explicitly said that stakeholder capitalism is not woke politics, it's capitalism. That's a defense of the system that concedes the critique.
The best defense is a good offense, or in this case, absorbing the language of your critics and hoping they don't notice.
That's the tension running through the whole spectrum. At every point, there's a version of the reform that's genuine and a version that's co-opted. ESG can be a tool for real accountability or a branding exercise. Stakeholder capitalism can mean worker representation on boards, or it can mean a paragraph in the annual report. UBI can be a floor for human dignity, or a way to justify gutting every other social program. The same policy mechanism can serve radically different visions depending on the political context around it.
The spectrum isn't just about what you propose. It's about what else you're doing while you propose it.
And this is why the lipstick on a pig critique that the prompt mentions has real bite. If you implement ESG reporting requirements without changing the fundamental incentives that drive extraction, you've just added paperwork. The pig is still a pig. It's just wearing a sustainability report.
The counterargument from the Cohen school would be that changing the reporting eventually changes the incentives, because capital flows shift over time. The lipstick, applied consistently, alters the pig's behavior.
And that's an empirical question, not just a philosophical one. We're running the experiment right now. Global sustainable investment assets hit about $35 trillion by 2020, according to the Global Sustainable Investment Alliance. That's real money. The question is whether it's changing real-world outcomes or just changing the composition of portfolios.
My suspicion, and I'm curious if the data backs this, is that it changes outcomes at the margins. A coal plant doesn't get built here, a renewable project gets funded there, but doesn't touch the core dynamics of accumulation and inequality.
The evidence so far is mixed. There are studies showing that ESG funds don't actually have lower carbon footprints than conventional funds once you control for sector and size. There are other studies showing that engagement by large asset managers does shift corporate behavior on specific issues like board diversity and climate disclosure. It's not nothing. It's also not a transformation.
The marginal versus the structural, again. Which brings us back to the rental crisis here in Israel. That's a case where the marginal fixes have clearly failed. You can't ESG your way out of a housing market, where apartments are financial instruments first and homes second.
Israel is actually a fascinating case study because the housing crisis here combines several of the dynamics we've been talking about. You have extreme concentration of land ownership. The Israel Land Authority controls about 93% of the land. You have a planning system that's slow and politically captured. You have investors buying apartments as stores of value, often leaving them empty. And you have a population growing faster than housing supply. None of these are fixable with better disclosure.
The fix would require, what? Public housing at scale, land reform, vacancy taxes, rent control with teeth. That's deep in the regulatory band of our spectrum, if not further.
Yet the political conversation here is still mostly about tweaking tax rates for investors and tinkering with planning approvals. The gap between the scale of the problem and the scale of the proposed solutions is enormous.
Which is maybe the most damning critique of the tinker with capitalism approach. Not that it's wrong in principle, but that it's insufficient for the problems we actually face. The tinkering toolkit wasn't designed for a housing emergency or a climate emergency.
That's where the more radical proposals draw their energy. If the moderate tools can't handle the job, you either find bigger tools or you question whether the toolbox itself is the problem.
Let's talk about the political viability of all this. Because a spectrum of ideas is intellectually interesting, but if most of them are politically dead on arrival, it's an academic exercise.
The viability question is brutal. The degrowth and post-capitalist ideas have almost no purchase in mainstream politics anywhere. Even in Europe, where the Overton window is further left, the actual policy conversation is about things like carbon pricing and industrial strategy, still very much within the growth paradigm. The Green New Deal in the U.S. is ambitious by American standards, but it's fundamentally a jobs and investment program, not a challenge to capitalism.
The most radical thing that's politically alive is probably some version of stakeholder capitalism plus a wealth tax. That's where the Sanders and Warren campaigns landed. That's where much of the European social democratic left is.
Even that is struggling. The wealth tax proposals in the U.S. went nowhere. The global minimum corporate tax that the OECD negotiated got watered down repeatedly. The political headwinds against any redistribution, let alone pre-distribution or systemic change, are incredibly strong.
Which creates a kind of doom loop for the reformist position. The reforms that might save capitalism's legitimacy are blocked by the people who benefit most from the current arrangement, which accelerates the legitimacy crisis, which strengthens the argument of the burn-it-down crowd.
That's the dynamic. And you can see it playing out in real time. Trust in institutions keeps falling. Polling shows younger generations are more open to socialism as a concept. Whether that translates into actual political programs is a different question, but the trend is there.
Where does that leave us? We've built this beautiful spectrum, and the conclusion seems to be that the viable part is too small to fix the problems, and the adequate part is too radical to be viable.
I don't think that's quite the conclusion. I think the spectrum shows that ideas migrate over time. Universal basic income went from a fringe thought experiment to a serious policy discussion in about a decade. Employee ownership used to be considered radical, and now it has bipartisan support in parts of the U.S. The Overton window does shift.
You're a cautious optimist.
I'm an observer who's learned not to confuse the current moment with the permanent condition. In 1980, the idea that the Soviet Union would collapse within a decade seemed absurd. In 2008, the idea that the U.S. Federal Reserve would keep interest rates near zero for years seemed unthinkable. Systems that look permanent turn out to be contingent.
The sloth perspective. Play the long game.
The long game doesn't guarantee a good outcome, but it does mean that today's political impossibilities are not necessarily tomorrow's. The question is whether the problems we're dealing with, climate, housing, inequality, will wait for the politics to catch up.
That's the anxiety underneath all of this. The feeling that the clock is ticking faster than the political process can move.
Which is, ironically, exactly what the late capitalism diagnosis was supposed to capture. Not that capitalism is about to collapse on its own, but that its internal contradictions are accelerating to a point where something has to give. Mandel was writing about this in the 70s, Jameson in the 90s. The feeling of acceleration isn't new. What's new is the material consequences catching up. The fires, the floods, the unaffordable cities.
We end on a question rather than an answer, which feels appropriate.
The prompt asks for a spectrum, and I think we've built one. From transparency to transformation, from ESG to anarcho-syndicalism, with a lot of contested territory in between. The value of laying it out this way is that it forces you to be specific about what you're actually proposing and what theory of change you're relying on. Are you fixing the dashboard, changing the rules, redistributing the assets, or building a new vehicle entirely?
Most people, when pressed, haven't actually thought through where they land on that question. They know they're unhappy. They haven't done the taxonomy.
Which is fine. That's what conversations like this are for. You don't have to have a fully worked out political program to sense that something's wrong. But if you're going to advocate for a solution, it helps to know where it sits relative to all the other solutions, what assumptions it makes, and what the track record is.
The prompt also mentions Sir Ronald Cohen specifically, and I think we've given his approach a fair hearing. Impact investing is the complete capitalism argument. It's a serious proposal from a serious person. The question is whether it's sufficient.
The answer depends entirely on your diagnosis of the problem. If you think capitalism's core issue is unpriced externalities, then impact accounting is the solution. If you think the core issue is the concentration of power and the growth imperative, then impact accounting is a band-aid on a broken leg. The spectrum doesn't resolve that disagreement, it just maps it.
Which is useful in itself. At least you know what you're disagreeing about. And now, Hilbert's Daily Fun Fact.
In the 1910s, on the island of Réunion, a French colonial administrator introduced the vanilla vine to local farmers using a hand pollination technique developed by a 12-year-old enslaved boy named Edmond Albius in 1841. That technique, using a thin stick or blade of grass to lift the membrane separating the male and female parts of the flower, is still the method used for virtually all hand-pollinated vanilla in the world today.
A 12-year-old solved vanilla pollination, and we're still using his method. That's genuinely remarkable.
The entire global vanilla industry rests on a child's botanical insight from 1841. I need to sit with that.
This has been my weird prompt. Thanks to Hilbert Flumentop for producing. If you want more episodes, find us at myweirdprompts.com or wherever you get your podcasts. Until next time.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.